If you can go to your notes, we're going to spend the next 3 or 4 weeks looking at Genesis 1 and the 6 days of creation. We'll start off looking at some definitions. The first one is concordism. And concordism is the attempt to read modern scientific discoveries into biblical texts. And so we're going to suggest that that's a wrong approach to approach Genesis 1. Reading what we know about science into Genesis 1 is not the way it was written. Now, I'll give you some examples. Some of them are a little bit out there, but you've heard of them, of concordism. Black helicopters. Now, those of you who are in dispensationalism, what do I mean by that? Yeah, there's an image in the book of Revelation of black locusts that sting and destroy. And so those who have tried to connect that with anything modern scientific thought black hot, this references black helicopters in our day. Now, how many have heard that before? Raise your hand. Look at that. More than half of you. So that's an example of concordism. Looking at a biblical text and trying to match it to something in our day that we are familiar with that they wouldn't have been familiar with scientifically. Every eye will see him. Now, that is a description of the return of Christ. There are some that have suggested that the return of Christ must be on television or YouTube. Why? Because that's the only way scientifically every eye could see the return of Christ at the same time, if it was televised around the world. Because how scientifically can every eye see him on all parts of the globe? Has anyone heard that theory? Okay. Wow, a lot of them. So that's another example of concordism, of trying, and concord, think of agreement, trying to agree a text with our knowledge of modern science. Young Earth creationism is an example of concordism, trying to agree with what we know about the world today with Genesis 1, as if it's referencing everything scientifically we know. Or trying to use the Bible to say that, well, the earth is round as a globe, because that's what we know, so that must be what they referenced when they spoke of the earth. But also, day-age creationism makes the same mistake. Day-age and young earth creationism, Morris and Ham, people like that, day-age says, all right, now that we know that the earth is, back then they would say millions of years old, then every age in Genesis 1, every day must be a certain age. Like each day represents certain millions of years. So they're trying to read our scientific knowledge in modern times back into the text. And so they must be referencing what we know scientifically. So those are examples of concordism. And all those are wrongheaded. Because as you see, concordism misunderstands the nature of Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is a stylized, non-literal, polemical, theological description of historic creation. Now, we're going to unpack all that in the coming weeks. Now, often the debate is, do you believe in a literal 6 days? A literal creation. And everyone throws around the world the word literal, but not everyone knows or agrees with what it means. Because there's three meanings of the word. Literal can sometimes mean plain. Literal just means clear. So is he being literal? We mean, is he being clear? Even if I use a figure of speech, if I use it in a way that everybody gets it, nobody questions it, you could say that's the literal meaning. In other words, the plain meaning. Sometimes literal means historical. So if I say that literally happened, what do I mean by that? That actually happened. It's another word for actually. It truly happened in history. It literally happened. So sometimes it means historical. Sometimes it means non-symbolic. In other words, there's no figurative language. And that's what we mean by literal. And so when people say, do you take Genesis 1 literally? Really, what do you mean by that? If you mean that it has a plain meaning, yes. If you mean that historically this happened, yes. But if you mean number three, there's absolutely no figurative, symbolic language, then no. There is a literary sense to Genesis 1 also. So let me give you an example. Look at Exodus 14. Exodus 14, 21 and 22. Exodus 14, 21 and 22 describes the parting of the Red Sea. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land, so the waters were divided. Then the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So what was the mechanism that God used to divide the waters? The wind, right? Now go to Exodus 15, and we have another description of the same event. But how is it described in verses 8 through 10? At the blast of your nostrils, the waters were piled up. The flowing waters stood up like a heap. The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea. And so, which one is true? Is it the wind or is it the blast of God's nostrils? It's both, right? What is Exodus 15 using? Poetic language. What does Exodus 14 use? Prose. Describing the scientific mechanism. There was a wind. Exodus 15 uses the same, or uses poetic language to describe the event. Now, which one is historical? Exodus 14 or Exodus 15? Which one is historical? Both. They both describe a historical event. Both describe something that actually, literally happened. But the language, the way it describes it, is different. One uses prose and one uses poetic language or poetry. But they're both historical. So if someone said to me, do you believe Exodus 15 is literally true? I'd say yes. Depends what you mean by literally. If you mean historically, yes. If you mean scientifically, no, that's not the purpose of poetry. So not literal in one sense. So often the debate about literal, people aren't even knowing what you're meaning or they're even meaning when they say it. So any thoughts on that point about the word literal in this debate? Yeah, and depending on what you mean, I think you're talking about sea now. Is it non-symbolic to us or them, right? Right. And it also shows when Christians debate, they often get really angry and debate and take stands, and no one even knows for sure what the other side is actually claiming. Yeah, there's straw man, there's accusations. Well, you don't believe in the historical, that it's literal. Well, depends what you mean. And so we have to consider, now we're under historical context, we have to consider the historical context of every passage in the Bible to interpret it correctly. And that includes Genesis 1. Moses was writing as Israel was outside the promised land, on the way to the promised land, most likely. It was pretty much the only time he could. So what did he want the Israelites to know about God? That's a question we have to ask. He's writing with the Israelites in mind, about to enter the promised land. In that historical situation, how does Genesis 1 help? What is he trying to reveal? The second is the pagan creation accounts that we will look at in the coming weeks. What did the Israelites already know about creation? What were the other accounts of creation already saying? And given that, how does this compare with the others? You're going to find some similarities between Genesis 1 and some of the pagan accounts, and yet some very stark differences. So we'll look at that. And then ancient cosmology. What did they already know? Remember in the first introduction to the class, we talked about what many in the church, like Calvin, the early church, said about Genesis, that God was speaking to their limited knowledge, that he always speaks to our ignorance, not to what we don't know. So, for example, when Jesus said the mustard seed is the smallest seed, that's what we knew. That's what they knew. He wasn't speaking to what they didn't know. And so now the ancients, or even Calvin, would use the term ignorance. We think of that as a negative. Oh, he's ignorant. It just means what they didn't know. And so what did they know? If you look at the television, the way the ancients looked at the world was only by what they saw with their eyes. They didn't have technology. They didn't have scientific models. All they could do is look around. And so you'll notice in that picture, this is the way they view the world. There was a firmament. Oh, isn't there no picture? Well, that is the way they know. So this is the way they view the world. Notice how they thought there was a heavens and then a firmament, which was something that literally was over the earth, because it says there was a firmament between the heavens and the earth. And so notice there are windows. Those doorways are windows, or what, the windows of heaven opening up, and that's where rain came down. So they didn't have the knowledge of what we call the evaporation cycle. And so they thought that the firmament opened and rain came down, the waters from the heavens. Now, where do you see that language in Genesis of the windows of heaven opening and the rain coming down? The flood account. The flood is speaking in a way that they saw the world. Another example of that is where it says in Joshua, the sun stood still. Did the sun scientifically stand still? The sun is always still. So what is it describing? It's describing our perception from their perspective, obviously. The sun is not moving anymore. It's not trying to give you a scientific explanation of rotation. It's just the way we see the world is the way God would speak. And so they actually believed that the heavens were opened with doors and the rain came down, and that's how Genesis is written. And so asking, what did they know? Now, they didn't believe the earth was flat, and they didn't believe the earth was a globe either. Why would they not believe either? They could only believe what they saw. And so what they saw when they looked around the horizon is a circle, like a disc. And that was the limit of what they understood. And so the earth, the world is described in a way that they would understand and see. God doesn't speak to them beyond what we could understand or know. And that's condescending to us. God doesn't tell us things that are way beyond our ability to understand, right? He speaks to us in what we understand and know. And God knows a lot more than we do, right? So we don't know the composition of atoms, for example. Or we can go so far that only God knows. The Bible doesn't speak in a way we would have no idea what that is. And so notice they have the pillars of the earth on the side. Can you see that? They thought there were pillars holding up the earth. The waters under the earth, Sheol, was a place down below. When you speak, the Old Testament speaks of sinking down to Sheol. That's what they thought. And so the earth wasn't flat. The earth wasn't round. It just went to a place and stopped, more like on a disc. But basically think about whatever you could see is what your view of the world was. Now, that's not us at all, because we've had, you know, rockets go above and take pictures of the earth. And so that's our concept of the world, because we see way beyond what with our eyes. But they didn't. Yeah, Cheryl. Yeah, the round one. Yeah. And so this is the ancient world to the Hebrews. This is what they viewed, and you'll find that the descriptions of the world to them match what they actually thought. And it's the same in the New Testament. Like I said, Jesus will only speak of what they know. And so the sun standing still is what we see, not what actually happened in a scientific sense. Any questions on that? We'll look a little more on that later, but yes. Right, but remember that even when the New Testament was written, they hadn't gone much further than this, because there was no way. So until they developed a telescope and started seeing things differently. And of course, the church, not understanding that God speaks according to what we know, when Galileo suggested that the sun didn't actually stop moving, the sun has never moved, we're moving. The church, not understanding this, condemned him for saying that. But that's not the way to understand Genesis. All right, let's get then into the introduction, which we'll develop now in the coming few weeks. Hints that the seven-day creation pattern is not to be taken literally, and when I say literally, I mean point C, non-figuratively or scientifically. Just like I said, the sun standing still is not to be taken scientifically, but it was historical. So everything in Genesis 1 is historical. It happened. But it's written using figurative language, and it was speaking of things that they saw. It wasn't introducing things that it was way beyond their ability to understand. So the first hint is the anthropomorphism of God, who comes down to earth as a workman, and he works 6 days and then he rests. That in itself is figurative language right away. God does not literally, in a physical sense, form, right? He just speaks. He's not working, and he's certainly not tired enough to rest at the end of the week. Now, when we speak of working and rest, that's what we understand, right? Where we work, we're tired, and we rest. But that's not what God is doing. So this is a picture, this is figurative language of a workman spending 6 days building something and then resting. And so right away, the picture of God coming down and working, it uses figurative language for God. And that's what anthropomorphism means. It means God appearing or being described as a person. Any questions on that? All right, the second one. The organization of the three-day triads matching Tohu and Bohu. We talked about that. Tohu and Bohu, the earth was formless and void. Tohu and Bohu. The first 3 days answer the question of formlessness. And then the second 3 days fills each of those first three realms with forms, with humans or animals, whatever matches. So there's a literary unfolding here. There's the first 3 days match formless and answer the question. The second 3 days match void, and each of them point to each other. And we'll look more at that next week. So there's a literary pattern here of how Genesis 1 is described. Now, if you turn to Genesis 1, probably the most obvious hint that concordism just doesn't know how to answer, or they don't answer it very well, is the fourth day compared to the first day. And so on the first day, then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And then go down to verse 14, the fourth day. Remember, the fourth is going to match the first day. And then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night." Well, he just did that on the first day. It said he separated the day from the night. The fourth day comes and God is separating the day from the night. So concordism would say, now we have to match that to science. And so there must have been another light source for the first 3 days. And then the fourth day, God introduces the sun to take over whatever that early light source was, it really goes kind of crazy beyond what the passage obviously is doing. What's happening in the fourth day is what already happened in the first day. But now we're getting more information. And we'll look at more of that next week. That's real common in Hebrew. And so the very purpose of the sun is to do what? In verse 14. The very purpose is to separate the night from the day. And yet we're already told in Genesis, the first day God separated the night from the day. He already did that. Why is he doing it again? And if there was a day and night, what understanding would there be a day and night without the sun? In what sense is that a day and night? It's certainly no sense they would have understood. So when people say, well, I take it plain literal, well, there's no literal day without the sun. So even you have to admit, you're not even taking it plain literally, because that doesn't make any sense. We don't have any concept of a sunless day. So you can either go one or two routes. You can say, like the young earth creationists have done, well, God had another form of light, or it was his own glory separating the day and night. Of course, the glory would be disappearing at night for 3 days. And then God decided not to do that anymore. Let's use the sun. You have to go there, or you could see what's more obvious, that in the fourth day, Moses is returning us to the first day and giving us more information. Here's how God separated the day and night. He filled the sky with the sun. Remember, realms in the first 3 days, so there's form, and then he fills those. Now he fills the sky with the sun. So it's easier to understand, it's plainer to understand the fourth day as returning to the first day, which shows us that we're not given this scientific chronological explanation. There's a literary pattern, which next week we'll look at why. Where is this all going? Any questions on number 3, the fourth day? When you see it up next week, I think it'll help. But just introducing, taking it plainly would be taking it as non-literal, is my point. Well, they both show purpose. Day 1, God is separating. That's the purpose. Day 4, the sun is separating. But it's given us more information of what God uses to separate, right? Right. So the next clue that the 6 days aren't to be taken in a literal scientific sense is the seventh day is not a 24-hour day, yet it's called a day. The seventh day in the Bible is an eternal day. When God rests in heaven, he doesn't wake up the next day, the eighth day, and go back to work. So the seventh day is an eternal day. Matter of fact, Hebrews 4 brings this out. We'll look at that a little bit next week very clearly. That God has entered his seventh day rest, and he's still there in his seventh day rest. And if we believe, we enter that rest, the writer of Hebrews says. And so if the seventh day is not a 24-hour day, that's your hint that none of these days are 24-hour days in a literal sense that we would think of it, that these are pictures, that this is figurative language. Because the seventh day is very clearly figurative language, and yet it still uses the word day. Now, I'm going to argue very clearly, I think you should see it, that the word day in Genesis 1 means on the 6 days day. It's a picture of a day. So it doesn't mean a long period of time. It means, like we would understand a day, but it's using the word day figuratively. And that's what the seventh day is obviously doing. It's a real stretch, and I've heard a few try to argue this, that the seventh day is also a 24-hour day. Because Hebrews 4 is real clear that that's not the case. All right, the next hint is the assumption of time on day 6. If day 6 is only a 24-hour day, literal 24-hour only, think of all that would have to happen in that same day. Because on that day, Adam and Eve were both created. That means Adam would have been created. Then he would have to go and name all the animals. How much time would that take to find all the animals, to look at their nature, their characteristics, and come up with a name? To become lonely, to figure out that none of these animals meet the needs he has, and he's lonely. To be put into a deep sleep, for Eve to be formed out of Adam, and then for him to see her. That literally would have to happen in 12 hours, because at night you wouldn't be able to see the animals, etc. So are we getting a sense that all this happened in 12 hours? Or would the plain sense be, this can't be a 24-hour day. There's just too much happening. That would take a lot of time. And then finally, and we'll get more to this when we get to the second chapter, Genesis 2, 5 and following, when it takes us back to creation and especially the garden, shows that ordinary providence was working during what was described in Genesis 1, during the 6 days. And so there needed to be rain, there needed to be man to prepare the garden, to till. All that was happening, even at the beginning, but we don't have time for that now. So all the hints are there not to take the 6 days literally. And we haven't even really got into exegeting. We're just starting out. And so, thoughts, questions? Now, let me just say before you do, if you hold to a literal 6 days, I don't mind at all. Believe what you want. But if you say that those who don't believe the Bible, or they're compromising their faith, then I would have issues with you. Because you're not even following historic Christianity here. And what you're doing is you're causing many people to stumble. And you're telling unbelievers that no matter what they study in science, they have to ignore it to be a Christian. And that's very wrong, very dangerous to do. So if all you want to say is, I read it as literal 6 days, but I understand how genuine Christians, sincere, could take it differently, I'm fine. I don't need to convince you. Now, I'd like to convince you, but it's not necessary to me. I just don't want you to go the other extreme that people are doing. If this started, the literal view only started in the 1960s among the Seventh-day Adventists. They're the one that introduced the idea that unless you believe the earth is young and these 6 days are literal, you don't believe the Bible. And that went from Seventh-day Adventism into mainstream fundamentalist Christianity, and people are making a lot of money off it now, building arcs and things like that. I have no idea who I'm talking about, right? So hopefully I can show you what Moses is doing. And then once you see, now next week we can open up the theology for a few weeks. Now that we know he's using figurative language, what's the point? And that really, once you can get there, you can see all the glories in it, which we'll look at. Yes. Right. Yeah, you're going to miss the theology if you're arguing over science the whole time. You're missing the point, which we'll get to. And I often have people say that to me. They say, well, don't you believe God can create the world in 6 days? Yeah, I believe he could create the world in a millisecond. And he doesn't need 6 days. We're not talking about what God could do. We're talking about what is written in the Bible and how it's described. Who was the famous person in history who thought God spoke everything all at the same time in 1 second, and then the 6 days were figurative pictures of the 1 second? I heard someone say it. Augustine. That's what Augustine taught. So he saw it as figurative, but then he saw it as not over time at all, but just God speaks and it's all there. And then he created a 6 day figurative pattern. Yes. Yeah, give that question about 4 weeks, because we'll do a whole class on that. 4 literal weeks. though that could be figurative the way the class sometimes goes, but. Yes. Right. Yes. And by the way, the word day, besides the 6 day pattern, is used 4 different ways in Genesis 1 and 2. Because at the end it says, and the day the Lord created all this. Now day is everything described. So even day is used very loosely. But I think the point is, in the 24-hour days, they are days. But it's a picture. It's figurative days, or we might call heavenly days, not our understanding, earthly days. Because the seventh day is obviously a heavenly day. It's a from which one day is now a picture. Other thoughts or questions? Yes. Yeah, that would be the view that each day represents thousands or millions of years. And that's concordism. That's trying to... We have a scientific view. Now we're going to match it with Genesis 1, which is not what Moses is doing, obviously. Yeah, because... Yeah, and that's the non-negotiable, that God spoke by the word of his power, our creation. Yes. All right. There's no one disagreeing with me. So just you wait. I guess we'll have to wait until the flood and we get to the extent of the flood, because this is about as bad as it gets. Yes. Yeah, the planets would be stars. They didn't have a distinction between planets and stars. That's what they saw. Lights in the sky. Alrighty, we'll come back next week and we'll look at the theology of why it's written this way, and let's pray.